This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Call it the Wall Street churn this past week as Fed Chair Jay Powell spent 2 days up on Capitol Hill taking questions on the economy and monetary policy, reiterating that officials are likely to take rates higher than previously anticipated and could move at a faster pace if needed. Based on Friday's mixed jobs report, investors now move their focus to this week's CPI report. And that's not the only risk for investors. More in a moment. Also ahead, the CEO of HPE, Antonio Neri, on tech spending. Claire Hughes-Johnson, former COO at Stripe, on a company's most important asset. And Priceline CEO Brett Keller with a global travel pulse check. All of that to come. We begin with a story in this week's finance section of the magazine. It was also a Bloomberg Big Take. It details a looming risk that investors simply don't want to consider. We're talking about the U.S. debt ceiling and what a default on federal debt would actually mean for markets. Bloomberg's Liz McCormick, Eric Wasson, Josh Wingrove, and Mike Dorning join forces to bring us both the Wall Street and Washington perspectives. Liz is Bloomberg News Chief Correspondent for Global Macro Markets. She and Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber join us with more.
We, in January, hit that debt ceiling, which they had set a bit ago. Now the Treasury Department is using extraordinary measures, kind of a special accounting moves to stay under it because they can't go above it. This is only going to get worse because there is, of course, a limit to how long Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and her team can do these maneuvers and stay under the debt limit. So they really need Congress to raise it or resuspend it, which they do many times.
I feel like part of the problem, though, is that, you know, we come up against this ceiling and then we always figure something out. What's different this time around, potentially?
Well, I think this time around, and, you know, the gentlemen on the story with me are the, you know, Washington politics experts. But, Eric Wasson will tell you that we have a very contentious situation here where both sides, you know, are jockeying. You know, the Republicans don't want a clean debt ceiling raise, which means that we just raise it. They want to kind of jockey for some future spending cuts. And President Biden and his team is saying, no, we don't want to do that. And, you know, they seem pretty entrenched, and it kind of harkens to 2011, where we had a very contentious debt ceiling episode that they eventually did come to something in the final hour. But it was such a messy process that the U.S. for the first time ever by S&P got their rating downgraded from AAA. And, you know, that had a sting, even though we didn't see rates jump up sharply then, you know, the stock market went down and it was a tumultuous time. So I think that's what people think this time is going to go down to the wire.
So that story that Eric Wasson did about Brendan Boyle of Pennsylvania, representative, top Democrat on the budget committee. When I read our story and then I read that story, I was like, oh boy, this is this got scarier all of a sudden, right? Because he's basically saying, like, we're not going to back down.
You know, it's funny, Joel, because everyone thinks, which we came to in our story, that of course they'll come to something. We've seen this movie before. It's a headache. We hate it, but they'll do it. But when, you know, you look at some of this stuff like Eric's laying out, it's really troublesome. And, you know, like, we hope, you know, cooler heads will prevail. No one would jeopardize the U.S. Treasuries as the world's safe haven security, which some people say people may not realize. If there's a default, be it short, you know, because they'll say, oh, well, it'll be short, you know, but that doesn't matter. You know, the U.S. doesn't default on their debt. And if they do, it could have repercussions for years and years.
Okay, so X date. We don't know when that is. What's our best sense of
when it is? Not a new dating app, is it, Joel?
No, it's not. X.com.
Darn that it was.
Brought to you by Elon.
Oh, darn. Yeah. Well, Janet Yellen says they have at least until like June. It seems like most of Wall Street is saying it probably goes until August. But it's very unclear because, you know, it's kind of coming at the worst time. We're in tax season, right? And the government doesn't know exactly how tax flows are going. I know I want a refund. They're trying to figure out.
Could you imagine if we didn't get our refunds?
I know. I know. I mean, that'll happen, but they don't know how the flows are going to be, how much, you know, the cash flows are going to go, how much refunds they're going to have to pay out, how much inflows, people paying their taxes. So it's very hard for the Treasury to kind of have a good timing of, you know, when we'll run out of these maneuvers.
Would it help if I was getting a refund and I said, why don't you guys just sit on it until August and like it's like Social Security a little bit and maybe I get a little bonus?
Wow, you're the man.
I'm just thinking, like, if I can do my part.
He has a big heart. He really does.
I don't think I'll give mine
up. By the way, whatever refund I'm giving is nowhere near what we need to.
What rate do you want on that?
Exactly.
So that's made it harder. That's why, you know, we know in past times what a lot of the traders do is say, hey, listen, I'm not buying any treasury bills or bonds that have coupon payments, which is this semi-annual interest that's coming around that crazy X date time. But now this X date range is so wide that it's kind of murky in the market, right? People are like, I don't know yet what debt to avoid, right? So maybe that will become more clear as troublesome when we get a better date, you know? Maybe we'll get an update from the Treasury of when that X date is going to be.
If the wheels start coming off this car ahead of that X date, do we have any sense what's going to break?
Well, you know, after 2011, a lot of the, we'll call it parties that be that oversee the treasury market did a lot. They were like, we don't want to go through this again with having no idea. So they did a lot of backup plans. Like, what if, like, maybe Treasury says, we'll delay the maturities a day. You know, well, they can deal with that. Because you have to remember, there's the repurchase agreement market that uses treasuries as collateral. So there's a lot of things that, you know, what if it couldn't even function? So there's been some backup plans. But even those officials say, but we're not sure. You know, we haven't been through this before. You hope the Treasury market will function. But Chairman Powell has also said, don't expect that the Fed can swoop in and make all cure all evils, that it would be repercussions on the economy for a long time. It may sting borrowing costs for years and years.
Explain that to me, that if indeed we get that default. I mean, if somehow then there's a quick fix after it, Liz, would we still have that long-term impact on the economy?
That's what a lot of people say. Of course, we don't know till it happens, but you know, some very smart people have said in various stories we've done that it could be cured very fast. But you have to think, some big investors say, I might add that I need a little cushion because, you know, the U.S. has defaulted, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so would say there might be some premium added to yields, not just for a day or two, maybe small, but as a baseline for a long time because it's totally different dynamic, you know?
Yeah.
What do we think on the Republican side? Is there any cracks anywhere in the wall that may be exposed here that may lead, you know, a small group of people to say, you know, we're not standing with McCarthy anymore?
Well, not yet. There's a few strongholds. Remember, McCarthy took so many votes to get him in as speaker, and he had to cut some deals. And, you know, that's made it harder because they also can kind of, let's just say in lay terms, spike him as the speaker. They have that option. So he has a lot of kind of payback to do. You know, Eric was saying that maybe, you know, McCarthy in the end, you know, will do the best for the country and say, you know, I'll fall on my sword and, you know, we'll make a bipartisan deal. You know, so it may go that way. But again, I think it comes down to markets getting ginned up, stocks selling off, and that being in the front of the local papers and things that policymakers may realize, oh, this is bad. And, you know, we'll come up with a deal. So it's just hard for me to believe that they won't. But like, you know, one investor said to me, I don't know, never say never. You know, don't know. You know.
Okay, so why throughout all of this, and whatever may come yet, the market's been kind of sanguine. Like, everything seems like it's not quite registered that this could go awry.
Well, I think there's a few things. One is, like we said, they can't kind of know yet exactly when we'll hit that wall. Number two, there's a lot of other problems, right? You know, inflation's going to be sticky, you know, not to minimize traders, but there's only so many things they can worry about at once, right? So the debt ceiling, they're kind of far away a little bit. We have seen U.S. credit default swaps, which is insurance against a default in the U.S. They're not a huge product here and they're not that liquid, but those, you know, rates have gone up. So there is a few people buying some hedges against a default, right? So I guess there's a little concern, but I think we need to get some more clarity, and you know, when this we could hit this wall for markets to really kind of like sell treasuries at that point and et cetera.
Have we heard anything from the biggest holders of U.S. Treasuries at this point? And I think about whether it's Japan, we always think about China. When you talk about maybe ultimately in the future, if we do get a default, they'll want more in terms of holding them. But have we heard anything from global investors on that front?
Well,
from sovereign nations?
Yeah, no, they haven't. I think they don't want to get in the middle of this fight. I'm sure if it gets down to the wire, you know, we've gone through this before. You know, China's a little bit, and they still hold a lot, but they're a little bit less of a player. U.S. has a lot more domestic investors than they ever had. So we're not getting into that political jockeying. And I don't think they would speak beforehand, but you do have private investors saying, like, I'm worried. Like, I think I had some story saying, oh, there's not going to be too much volatility ahead. And one investor emailed me, Liz, the debt ceiling. You know, so there are a lot of the private investors that are concerned that this could be, you know, a lot of havoc. And even if we don't get a default, if it goes down to the wire and there's real concern, you might see more selling of treasuries. Again, we have a backdrop of rates rising, inflation being sticky. There's a lot of concern out there anyway.
That was Bloomberg News Chief Correspondent for Global Macro Markets, Liz McCormick, along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Jill Weber. Jill will be back a little bit later on. Coming up, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise CEO Antonio Neri on his company's strong quarter. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec. From Bloomberg Radio.
So one way we've been trying to figure out what happens next in the global economy and financial markets is by listening to what CEOs are saying as they report earnings. With this quarter winding down, among the last major companies reporting was HPE, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, which last week gave a strong forecast for the current quarter and boosted its annual outlook. The company's results suggest corporations are still upgrading their technology infrastructures, even in an uncertain economy. Antonio Neri is president and CEO of HPE. He joined me and Bloomberg News Deputy Team Leader for U.S. Equities, Jess Benton, to dig into the company's numbers.
That the IT spend is resilient. That IT spend obviously shifting in different areas, but overall, I will say, continue to be a top priority for any enterprise of any size. And last week, I actually was in Europe talking to customers in France and Northern Europe, and they were all very clear with me, IT will continue to be a top priority for them, whether it's to improve the resiliency of the company, or whether it's to mine data through the analytics portion of the investment, or whether it is to also digitize their business. So overall, I will say it's good. There is some unevenness in some aspects, but overall, you know, when I think about our Q1 performance, which was record-setting for the company on every metric you look at it, revenue, operating profit, and EPS, and the fact that we have a very solid order book, it gave us the confidence to raise the outlook for both revenue and EPS.
I will say, and I had a conversation with our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst, Woo Jin Ho, who said, you know, they were stellar results, and you did raise your outlook. You know, we also went through Dell's report last night, and your outlook was very different in contrast to Dell's, which was much more dour. Why do you think there is that disparity that we're seeing in the industry? Because it's tough for us, as we see you guys all report and talk about it, we listen to the C-suite, similar companies having some, you know, different outcomes.
I think it's because people just look names and that they kind of put all together in the same bucket. But the fact of the matter is we have a complete different portfolio. Obviously, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise does not participate in the PC business. That's our, you know, former parent company that now is independent, HP Inc. But we have a unique diversified portfolio, which makes us very different than Dell. We have an intelligent connected business, which Dell does not have. We have an AI business at scale that Dell does not have. So you have to look at the portfolio, and that's why it makes us very different. But also we have a different strategy because our strategy is to offer everything that we develop inside the company, whether it's edge, cloud, and AI, in a platform-oriented approach, not selling, you know, systems or commodity hardware. And that's what is so different. That's why customers and investors need to learn more about that. And that's why we are a little bit more bullish than they are.
We definitely have seen a fundamental trade off of specific stories, Jess.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up Antonio when it comes to the cloud. You did announce how you do have that definitive agreement to acquire Axis Security, and that could help push you deeper into that space. What are you expecting to come out of that? And are you expecting to have any more potential acquisitions on the horizon?
Well, over the last 8 weeks, we acquired four different assets, always in these three domains: edge, cloud, and AI. The first one was a company called Pachyderm that allows us to do data pipeline automation for deploying AI at scale. So we have a unique asset with supercomputing that now becomes a, kind of the old tech becomes the new tech in many ways, because you need supercomputing power to train these very large models. And one of the challenges customers have is to train those models in a very large scale data pipeline. The second asset we bought was a company that does software-defined compute for in-memory workloads. Think about those workloads like database that needs a lot of memory. We can now do that at cloud scale. The third one was private 5G. So when we think about the edge, the ability to provide a ubiquitous connectivity layer from Wi-Fi to LAN to software-defined wide area network, now we are bolted into the same architecture, the private 5G, because Wi-Fi and private 5G are very complementary, and that's a company called Athonet. And last but not least, the one you mentioned, which is access security, because you need to wrap all that connectivity layer with a secure access, secure edge. And we will have the most complete portfolio in the connected intelligent edge. And that's an opportunity to continue to grow in the adjacent market, but ultimately customer want an integrated, secure solution.
You've also been tied to Nutanix. Is something likely to happen there?
We always, you know, we don't comment on speculation. I will say we always look for assets that accelerates our journey into these three domains. You know, for us, it's all about accelerated momentum with HP GreenLake. HP GreenLake is a flagship product. And one of the metrics I quoted yesterday is that with the HP GreenLake and the total as-a-service business, in 2021, Q1 2021, our total contract value was $5 billion. At the end of Q1 2023, our total contract value on the balance sheet is $10 billion. Mm-hmm. So we doubled that business. And obviously, we look at always assets that accelerate that strategy, particularly in the software, defined kind of layer,
right,
as well as automation.
What about a larger strategic deal? Is that something that could happen?
You know, we look at all type of assets, but one of the things my CFO and I hold ourselves accountable to is a disciplined, return-based investment. And, you know, with the last four acquisitions, I have now done more than 30 acquisitions in the last 6 years or so. And all of them fits in that consistent framework where we bring unique IP and talent that we can scale to our go-to-market. And obviously, as valuation come down from the highs and multiples that were in some cases not justifiable, we look at all of them. But again, we stay strict to that framework.
Yeah.
One of the criticisms came to the guidance and your momentum moving forward and how that momentum could actually slow in the second half of the year. Is that something that's more of a potentially conservative estimate and something that might be, we could see some revisions there happening, depending on how obviously the business outlook changes and the macro outlook as well?
You know, I have to tell you, sometimes I don't understand some of these questions, because when you think about it, you know, at the end of Q4 2022, which we had an outstanding quarter, we guided for the full year 2-4% year-over-year revenue growth for 2023. With the new guidance, we are doubling that revenue from the midpoint 3 to now 5-7, meaning midpoint 6. So I don't call that conservative. You know, when you double the revenue guidance, I don't call that conservative. And in addition to that, let's remind ourselves, we're also raising the earnings per share guidance by another 6 pennies. Notwithstanding, we have a massive headwind on currency. You know, our 18% year-over-year revenue growth, mm-hmm, that we've just posted,
yeah,
had a 550 basis points headwind. So we are prudent, you know, and this
Got
is
it.
Why we're just early in the year.
That was Antonio Neri, President and CEO of HPE. He joined me and Bloomberg News Deputy Team Leader for U.S. Equities, Jess Menton. Jess will be back in the next hour. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, a decorated tech executive explains the most important building block of a successful company.
If you're not investing in yourself as a leader and manager or in your talent, you're going to have a problem, because you need more out of them. And you can't let growth paper over challenges. I do think the pandemic caused more disconnection.
Agreed.
So if you're not reconnecting, it's going to get worse. There seems to be something soft in saying people investment or people matter, when in fact, I think the best places, the best managers and leaders have very high standards, but also deep devotion. Right? It's the marriage of the caring and the expectations. And I worry people were like, well, we've got to just take our foot off the gas because, yeah, there was a pandemic. Terrible things have happened in this country and around the world. And it is very hard and people are tired. But you know what? We want to be inspired. We want to be inspired by where we work and the people we work with. And if you don't have a high standard coupled with that empathy and that devotion and that investment, you're not doing your job and you're not going to get the results.
Stripe executive and Silicon Valley veteran Claire Hughes-Johnson provides her playbook for better business practices in any industry. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, so you know we've had lots of conversations with heads of companies and organizations of all sizes. One common denominator, the fight for workers in today's tight labor market. We got another read, as you know, on the U.S. employment picture with the monthly data released on Friday. Well, our next guest knows a lot about people management and building a company thanks to its people. Claire Hughes-Johnson spent 10 years at Google. She oversaw some key projects. She is a corporate officer and advisor to Stripe, was COO at Stripe. She's got a new book out, Scaling People, Tactics for Management and Company Building. She explains some common pitfalls of today's business leaders.
What we've probably done is thought that just people management will come naturally to us. But I do think it's learnable. I mean, I think a lot about scaling people is just like, let's break down some of the stuff that happens in private. The one-on-ones, the performance conversations, let's expose what happens, but actually do the work. If you're not investing in yourself as a leader and manager or in your talent, you're going to have a problem because you need more out of them and you can't let growth paper over challenges. I do think the pandemic caused more disconnection.
Agreed.
So if you're not reconnecting, it's going to get worse.
And that doesn't change when we get into a softer labor market?
I think the best companies make this investment no matter what.
Okay.
I do think, though, in a softer labor market, sure, people start taking some things for granted. One of the things that bothers me often is companies, obviously they're obsessed with their business, with their product, with their growth, but your people for a lot of companies are what's producing all of that. And the whole hypothesis of scaling people is you want great results, this is the investment you make, because in the long term, that's what's going to produce them.
What is, though, the biggest mistake that people kind of make?
There are two things that I think often happen. One is thinking you need everyone to like you. And you're not your team's best friend. I'm sorry. And the other is not, you need to manage different people differently. And I think a lot of people take the golden rule, well, I'm going to manage people the way I like to be managed.
Yeah.
But guess what? They're different than you. It's like the opposite of the golden rule. What motivates them? What kind of challenge? How do they take feedback? You need to be studying your team and yourself to understand how to adapt and adjust. And I actually think it's very doable, but maybe the third mistake is not taking the time to do it.
Well, it's interesting too, and I think about as you were helping Stripe, as you were working at Google, right? Building out these incredible companies, right? But at some point, it's probably crazy. You're running after a million different things. The last thing you're like, all right, what does Joe need or what does Jay need in terms of an employee? But it's really important.
It is. At the end of, I think the longest chapter in the book is about hiring.
Yeah.
And at the end of the chapter, I found myself, because it's true, I've been in very high growth environments. I've been part of building two, you know, arguably pretty definitional companies, Google certainly, and Stripe we hope to be. And at the end of the chapter, I found myself writing, if you've gotten to this point, you probably think I'm insane for recommending all of these things that you need to build and want to build into your hiring and your onboarding process. And it's very tactical. They're like specific steps.
Right.
And how to interview and teach interviewing. I said, but, you know, if you believe talent is everything, you know, or that hiring is everything, then talent is everything. And your hiring process has to reflect that.
Well, it's interesting because I do feel like in part of the narrative, the corporate narrative, certainly coming off the pandemic, right? Certainly coming off of George Floyd and everything, mm-hmm. it's people, you all matter, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. And, you know, the working from home, do what you need to do. But I do feel like I wonder if the narrative, maybe the narrative's there, but the actions aren't. And what are you seeing, or what do you think? Does it just... Yeah. Has That's, something changed fundamentally?
Here's what I worry about in that, which is there seems to be something soft in saying people investment or people matter, when in fact, I think the best places, the best managers and leaders have very high standards, but also deep devotion, right? It's the marriage of the caring mm-hmm. and the expectations. And I worry people were like, well, we've got to just take our foot off the gas because, yeah, there was a pandemic. Terrible things have happened in this country and around the world. And it is very hard and people are tired. But you know what? We want to be inspired. We want to be inspired by where we work and the mm-hmm. people we work with. And if you don't have a high standard coupled with that empathy and that devotion and that investment, you're not doing your job and you're not going to get the results.
All right. So because you're here and you have this incredible background, I only have a couple of minutes left. So you have to promise you're going to come back because I'd love to talk more. But tell me about some of the interesting trends that are going on. We're talking so much about AI. Mm-hmm. What is it that you find? You're at Google. I mean, the moonshot, like, you know, there's just so much stuff. What is it that you find interesting?
I love working with founders and I love all of the new things that are happening. You're absolutely right. It's like you just turn around and there's an exciting project happening in lots of companies of all sizes. I think AI is real. It is incredibly innovative, but what's really interesting about it to me is it's less of a technology that is like there's one or two winners
kind of
a thing, right? It, like an Android and an Apple, right? This is much more fragmented and dispersed, and it's very accessible to a lot of different companies. It'll be very interesting to see how companies sort of innovate around AI as part of their core business. And I think a lot of the best companies will.
Is it a conversation you guys are having about?
I think every company, I'm on a bunch of boards too. I'm on the board of HubSpot. Yeah. Every company is having that conversation.
Really, really fascinating. I have a million more questions. Working from home, is it here? Going to go away?
I think some version of it is here, but okay. It means you have to be in person on some regular basis, in my opinion.
That's Claire Hughes Johnson, corporate officer and advisor to Stripe. Her new book just out. It's called Scaling People: Tactics for Management and Company Building. So Claire is scaling people while our next guest is helping to scale up the everyday feminist as we marked International Women's Day this past Wednesday. Latonya Mapfret is the president and CEO of Global Fund for Women. She's a former executive director of Planned Parenthood Global and UNICEF Human Rights Officer who also spent a decade with the United States Agency for International Development. Latonya's new book, entitled The Everyday Feminist, The Key to Sustainable Social Impact, Driving Movements We Need Now More Than Ever. It came out on International Women's Day, which she joined me and Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan to talk about her organization's work.
Global Fund for Women has been around for about 35 years, and it started with the concept that we should just fund women, period.
That's
because,
nice and simple.
You know, because there's so many different reasons why we needed to do that. And back then, honestly, 35 years ago, it seemed a little bit groundbreaking that you should fund a woman to do the business of supporting the community. We're so
biased.
You're
talking about the mid-80s, right?
Yeah, we're talking about about 87. Yeah. So it was very difficult to get funds to women, particularly in the international setting. But still, you know, we're struggling with so much of this. But it is just women who don't fit a scenario. And we have some real biases in our cultures and our communities around women who are doing just everything, but yet are undervalued, overlooked. And when it comes to getting them resources, people just feel uncomfortable just giving them money to do these things that are quite entrepreneurial,
creative, innovative.
Okay, so let me just start with some of the, you know, one of the first grants from Global Fund for Women went to Lima Gbowee. And Lima Gbowee, as many of you know, Pray the Devil Back from the Disney documentary, actually just was a woman who wanted peace in her country. After three civil wars, she was tired of the actual table of peacemakers being all men. She thought, and she felt seriously about the fact that maybe we should have some women at that table and women that are living these real experiences that are going on in Liberia. So Global Fund for Women gave her $10,000 ratchet that back, $10,000. Very different.
Probably felt like
it's a business show. So $10,000.
Gotta get the numbers right.
Oh, I mean, of course it did. Yeah. And she didn't have an organization. She wasn't registered. You know, she didn't have a bank account. We gave her $10,000 to get buses to take women from Liberia to Accra, to Ghana, to chain themselves around a building where they were holding peace talks with all these men, both the opposition, the government, and other actors, international actors. And they would not let them come out until they had a peace accord signed. And that's what they did. And that's the kind of money we're talking about that Global Fund for Women does. And this is this long-term social change that we keep talking about that is so valuable, but yet that we don't get behind, you know? And so that's what Global
Fund for Women. Because we talk too much and we don't actually put the money to work.
It's a lot of rhetoric. It's a lot of sort of cultural understanding of what women should do and what they should ask for when they do it. And maybe they should just be able to do it without asking, you know? So it's this kind of thinking that really is the emphasis behind the everyday feminist.
That's LaTanya Mapfret, President and CEO of Global Fund for Women. More from our conversation is coming up, including her response to the backlash against critical gender equality initiatives. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so let's get back to our conversation with LaTanya Mapfret. She's the president and CEO of Global Fund for Women, which provides feminist funding for grassroots organizations around the world. Her new book, The Everyday Feminist, The Key to Sustainable Social Impact, Driving Movements We Need Now More Than Ever. LaTanya joined Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan and me and shared that almost anyone can contribute to the cause.
These are ordinary women. I mean, of course, we love the Jacintas and the Kamalas of the world who are, you know, stepping up in amazing ways and breaking the glass ceiling. But don't forget about the women who are the head of the BTAs, the nurses who are taking care of your elderly parents and pushing back.
What's different about feminism outside the U.S. versus like a developed country? Is
it
different?
Well, let me just say, I think that the word has gotten to be so taken out of context. It's, you know, I mean, feminist, you know, these are people who believe that men and women are equal and should be able to proceed likewise in our culture. But there is, you know, there's a sort of background to feminism, especially in the North, the global North. I mean, my grandmother, when I was little, told me she is no feminist. That's white, rich women who have time to think about gender all day. But yet in the book, you'll see she's probably one of the biggest feminists I know who stand up when women are, you know, need to be stood up for. And so I think, you know, there's this new renaissance among feminism. So the word can now be used in business. It can be used in sports. It can be used in our homes in ways that I think we're just now getting again to get acquainted with the word. So I'm happy about that. So
do we let the guy speak or should
we not? Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry. I'm chatting along.
No. I'm having fun with you.
I was going to say, I have three daughters, so I'm very familiar with funding women. I guess
we'll give them 30 seconds.
We'll give them 30.
But LaTanya, you know, you can't help but worry about this backlash that's going on politically to inclusion, diversity programs among some of the far right politicians out there. Is that affecting the Global Fund at all, or is it actually invigorating donations and sort of the enthusiasm for it?
Well, let me just start with, I do get a little worried. I just saw OECD data, you know, so this is the money that's coming from mainly Global North countries and the assistance that they give into Global South spaces. We track that every year. There's a report that comes out on gender equality. In 2021, we started seeing a backlash. So the report has not come out for 2022, of course, but we saw the numbers actually decline when in other spaces of grant making, charity, and other you know, things had gone up. It was the COVID area, of course, and it was also a time when women were experiencing more violence at home than they did at any time. So yet the money going directly to grassroots groups, women's groups, was actually lower. So I am a little bit worried about those numbers. So I'll start there. But I'll say for Global Fund for Women, we are constantly in conversation with and building new ways of getting money to local organizations around the world, and in particularly these women's groups that are doing this work. So we start partnering with, we're at the Resilience Fund, which is a group of fashion industry. It's the Gucci's, it's the Amazon Amazons, the Gaps, H&Ms, and so forth.
Yeah.
And starting to, and I shouldn't be naming them, I'm sure. I'm sorry.
Too late.
It's too late, right? It's out there. But they're actually, they're working with women's funds to fund women, trust women, to let them do work in the factories where they work to make sure that their rights are met. It's a new way of thinking about it, and I'm excited about that piece of it. So even if the total money is going down, the ways we're getting money to let women do what they do best in their countries, in their sectors, in the way that makes sense.
That's Latonya Mapfret, President and CEO of Global Fund for Women. Her new book, The Everyday Feminist, The Key to Sustainable Social Impact, Driving Movements We Need Now More Than Ever. Bloomberg's Mike Regan sticking around for our next segment. That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Ahead in our next hour, we take a look at the global travel business with the CEO of Priceline, Brett Keller. Plus Ferrari's first ever SUV, although they kind of refuse to call it that. You'll hear more on that in a moment. And we've got to look at Google's scramble to catch up on AI. We're talking a code red kind of scramble.
They are just so terrified of being leapfrogged in a field that they really helped to lay the foundation for when it comes to generative AI.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser. Stay with us. Today's top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenebeck on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including Priceline CEO on travelers running off to catch planes and travel deals. We're jumping on the Pony Express, aka Ferrari's SUV, the first they've ever made. And who is in the market for those global multi-million dollar homes? First up this hour, though, Google's plan to catch ChatGPT. The OpenAI chatbot is all the rage. And with that, we turn to the technology section of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, and a story that opens up with the following line: artificial intelligence was supposed to be Google's thing. And yet we have spent a lot of the last few weeks talking about Microsoft's narrative-changing and eye-popping $10 billion investment into ChatGPT. So why does a tech titan that's been involved in AI for years now appear to be behind the curve? With more on that, Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan and I turn to Julia Love, Bloomberg News tech reporter who co-wrote the piece with Davey Alba. Julia joins us along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, and Businessweek technology editor, Joshua Brustein.
AI has been a long-running theme of Silicon Valley coverage for quite some time. And throughout the newsroom, you know, we saw Google as one of the companies that was pretty far ahead. It had a reputation for building, you know, products like the auto complete and emails, just building it kind of into everything. But I think everyone was a little bit stunned by just the reaction to ChatGPT, sort of how much it showed a glimpse at what could be the future, mm-hmm. and how much it seemed to change everything. And so, you know, we set out to see, like, well, Google, who did not get, who suddenly doesn't seem like they're far out ahead, like, how are they reacting? And Julia and Davey found that they were reacting pretty significantly behind the scenes.
Julia, come on in. Give us some color about what was going on at Google.
Sure. So it's really a fascinating moment at Google because they are just so terrified of being leapfrogged in a field that they really helped to lay the foundation for when it comes to generative AI. And so we learned through sources that the company's senior leadership has issued a directive that all the company's most important products must incorporate generative AI in the coming months. We have also heard that CEO Sundar Pichai is getting his hands dirty and diving into minute details of product development. That's the type of work that normally would be handled three or four layers below him in the organization. And you know, in general, employees feel like working on generative AI is something that can, you know, raise their profile within the organization. But there's also a lot of anxiety in the company right now. They just really don't want to fall behind.
What I was interested in, among other things here, is just the tension within the company. So, Julie, what did you learn as you reported? You know, what are people comparing this to?
people outside the company are worried that this experience, you know, the declaration of the Code Red, risks repeating Google Plus, the ill-fated social network that some of you
may
recall.
I didn't even remember that.
Yeah. Oh, we do.
Circles, baby, circles.
Go ahead, Julia.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. You know, it's the parallel that people see is that normally Google is a pretty, you know, bottom-up place. Employees and different teams have a lot of freedom to, you know, sort of chart their own course. But Google Plus was one of the last times that the company said every product must have a social component. And it didn't turn out well. So some folks now seeing the company do something similar with this generative AI Code Red are worried about seeing history repeat itself.
What was the biggest thing that you learned while you were working on this, Julia?
I think for me, you know, we had been hearing a lot about the Code Red, but we had imagined, we'd envisioned it as something that was really impacting the artificial intelligence researchers, the search team. What our reporting over the past few weeks showed me was that this is something that is on every single Googler's mind, and that for many people, more and more people, is starting to influence their workflow.
Joshua, come on back in here. Google not alone, to be fair. I mean, Meta's also been scrambling. Salesforce VC, they're putting some money. I mean, everybody is kind of figuring out where they need to be in this. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, yeah. We're in like full-on Silicon Valley hype cycle right now. I feel like overnight, all of our inboxes, which had been filled with pitches for blockchain companies, just seamlessly switched to chatbot companies. Everyone's trying to figure out like where their space is in it. One little tidbit in this piece, which I think will hopefully be grist for further reporting down the road, is that the company formerly known as Facebook, which you might remember changed its name because the metaverse was everything, is apparently now focused increasingly on this kind of AI and maybe like eyes wandering away from the metaverse a bit. So it's definitely a thing that, you know, everyone is thinking is existential.
It's now AI-verse. Get ready.
I mean, to be real here, like what Google has already is an incredible product that has dominated for decades. Metaverse, definitely, you know, nascent, let's say. Everybody uses Google. Not everybody uses Meta. For Google here, I think that the risk becomes, like, do they mess it up along the way? And what kind of reality and what kind of conversations are happening within the company about that tension?
Yeah, you know, Google executives have said over and over again that they take very seriously the responsibility that they have as the world's key provider of information. You know, these large language models frequently hallucinate, meaning they will deliver incorrect information with conviction. And while ChatGPT might be able to get away with that as sort of a newfangled product that we're all playing around with, the stakes are much higher when it's Google.
And also, not even just hallucinate, you know, there are stories when Bing introduced a beta version of its new chatbot. You know, there's a New York Times reporter who had a very alarming exchange with the chatbot where the chatbot tried to convince him to leave
fall in love
and leave his wife. So it seems to me like we're almost, and you know, the backlash stage to the new technologies is hitting before it's even off the ground. You know, is there a risk there, do you think? I mean, is there any concern at least about a risk that everyone's moving too fast with this technology?
Yes, you know, it's funny. I did speak with one former Googler who told me that he was a little bit surprised that Google sort of put its foot to the gas after this announcement of ChatGPT. He said that he felt like if the company had just waited a few weeks or a month, that you know, Bing search would have self-immolated, in his words. And I think that yeah, Google had been acting cautiously, and the cautious approach may be the wise one in the long run.
Josh, I thought the way that the story ends was also really poignant, though, because bring in the Xerox reference.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Xerox PARC was a research lab that did a lot of the foundational research that led to the creation of what we think of as the modern PC, the sort of graphical interfaces, the mouse. And they had a lot of this stuff. It was being shown in demos. Some people who came to look at it, Steve Jobs, Microsoft, and those two companies, which are each now worth $1 trillion, really built something out of that. And Xerox PARC, which, needless to say, is not worth $1 trillion, did not commercialize. And, you know, Google does have something of a reputation of being better at the early stages of tech development than the final polished products. And I think it's something that people at Google are somewhat self-conscious about and aware of, and they really don't want to be the Xerox PARC of AI chatbots.
You know what I find fascinating is we keep calling this company Google when, as we all know, they changed their name several years ago to Alphabet, which was meant to reflect all those other investments they were making besides the search engine. So, Julia, that seemed like a very sort of unfocused scattershot strategy to sort of invest in a million different projects in a lot of different areas. Does this feel like that they're getting away from that and kind of focusing now more strictly on AI?
Yes. You know, I think that AI is something that is present across the Alphabet portfolio. Certainly Waymo, the self-driving car unit, is a different expression of artificial intelligence. But nevertheless, search ads still make up something like 80% of Alphabet's revenue. And so I think especially in these tough financial times, there is a recognition in the company that this is our bread and butter, and we need to make sure that we don't, squander any momentum in this race. You know, that's still the lifeblood of the company.
Our thanks to Julia Love, Bloomberg News tech reporter, Bloomberg Businessweek technology editor Joshua Brustein, and the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Joel Weber. Bloomberg's Mike Regan with us as well. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Up next, well, spring is near, right? You can feel that. And travelers, they are definitely looking to hit the road.
Families are really prioritizing travel this year, more so than last year. And most of them are heading to beaches and resort destinations. So if you want to go to one of those destinations, you can expect to find a lot of people traveling.
Priceline CEO Brett Keller is up next. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of Booking Holdings are up more than 25% so far this year. The company recently gave an earnings update that was last week, beating both on the top and bottom lines. Among the online travel company's brands, Priceline. Priceline CEO Brett Keller has been with the company for more than 20 years. He joined me and Bloomberg's Jess Metten with a positive outlook for Priceline and the broader industry.
Things are actually very good if you're in travel right now. Obviously, a very tough, 2020 and 2021, 2022 started to show some really nice signs. And for the last couple of quarters, the consumer has really demonstrated that they're prioritizing travel right now. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, we recently came out with our fourth quarter results, and it's showing real strength across, especially, across the U.S., but really across all markets around the world.
And I'm really excited with spring coming up, Carol and Brett. I was curious about what does the travel demand look like as we head into spring? Should we expect this strength to continue? I mean, when I think back to the holiday travel, there was a little bit of chaos when you thought about the airlines and some of that and the bookings. But what are you expecting for spring travel right now?
Sure. Well, consumers have essentially kind of fallen back into their typical booking patterns, meaning they're traveling on the busiest days of the year. So they're going to pack those spring break weeks, especially families when children have time off from school. Families are really prioritizing travel this year, more so than last year. And most of them are heading to beaches and resort destinations. So if you want to go to one of those destinations, you can expect to find a lot of people traveling. I think the airlines have, largely recovered and are operating at a pretty good scale now, but they still have limited capacity, which means planes will be very, very full. There's not really any slack in that industry at this time.
Gotta say, Brett, I get that. If you try to book a flight right now for business or otherwise, man, those flights are expensive. We're still kind of, blown away by how expensive it is. Does that continue? Because I'm thinking about the inflationary side of this story. What do you see in terms of costs for flights, for lodging? How is it playing out?
Sure. You know, when we look at forward bookings at the spring break timeframe, which is really, you know, most of March and April, what we're seeing is flight prices are up about 25% over last year. So very expensive. If you're trying to travel overseas, which a lot of people are now heading out to Europe, you're going to see prices up to 40% over what you were paying last year. On the hotel side, not so challenging. Hotel prices are up about 4 or 5%, so a little easier to consume those. But if you're trying to fly, you're going to pay a lot of money. So I think you'll see quite a few consumers in the U.S. Choosing to drive versus fly, and they'll get to their hotel destination that way. But it's a lot to consume right now, and consumers so far are inhaling those prices. We haven't seen either the hotel industry or the airlines really pull back on a lot of their price increases. And so as long as demand is there, we can expect those prices to stay rather high.
Brett, any sign that increased capacity comes into the airline industry? I mean, they've gotten so smart at taking out excess capacity. That was pre-pandemic. We saw that in a big way. They're great about charging for everything once you get on a flight or even on your way to that flight. Is there any signs or any indications that you're hearing that we get an increase in airline capacity?
Well, I think there's some early signs. I know all of the airlines would love to build up capacity. What they've been challenged with, of course, is hiring enough pilots and staff and ground crew to support the oncoming flow of equipment. There have been a number of new orders put in for planes. And so I think over the next couple of years, we'll see that start to ease. But, you know, getting us through the summer, I think what we have today on the market is pretty much what we're living with, which means a very stressed environment when it comes to, finding an airline ticket that is reasonably priced to a great destination. There are still deals to be found. You can still find reasonable locations to travel to, but you might have to be flexible if money is a really tight concern for you right now.
Britt, where exactly are the most affordable deals for spring break, whether it's in the US or maybe even internationally?
Sure. You know, if you're looking for a nice, warm beach destination, Fort Lauderdale, always a good option. Myrtle Beach, not the Miami Beach, but provide the same type of experience in some ways, especially for families. Puerto Rico is very popular right now. Obviously, Dominican Republic, Jamaica. So the Caribbean continues to be a reasonably affordable place to go. Overseas, you know, if you're trying to travel to the big cities like London and Paris, you're going to pay. If you are a little bit flexible and want to try something new, you can try something like Lisbon, Athens, Munich, even Naples. You know, those destinations, you'll pay maybe a touch less on the flight, but you're really going to save when it comes to your hotel and the average price you're going to pay there, as well as it's just a little cheaper to travel in some of those markets, especially Greece, a beautiful destination, and much more reasonable when it comes to the daily expenses for a consumer.
Sign me up. We're ready. Hey, listen, Brett, what I do wonder too is the window that you guys see globally, like, what are you seeing globally in terms of where there's lots of activity travel-wise? Is it largely the U.S.? I know here in New York City, as I walk the streets of New York, I'm seeing a lot more international travelers back on the streets.
Yeah, you know, the U.S. recovered first, and that was mostly due to domestic travel. The U.S. Borders obviously opened up a little sooner than some of the European borders and especially the Asian borders. And so we saw a number of international travelers begin to pour into the U.S. But Europe came back very strong in 2022 and is now moving at a very fast pace and catching up to the U.S. Asia was the longest. They took the longest coming out of COVID to really start to recover. But they are now ramping up very, very quickly. And I think in some countries, we're seeing demand outpacing 2019 because the travel was so constrained for so long. People are just desperate to go out and take vacations, visit friends and family, and just see the world.
Something else I thought was interesting in a survey that y'all had was looking at how spring breakers are basically split between going someplace new versus returning to a favorite destination. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, travel is one of those things that if you've had a great experience, you want to repeat it. And a lot of consumers, you know, when they find a favorite hotel or a favorite location, they know they can bank on that and count on that. And if they can get the price that they want, they're going to return to that destination. We see that a lot with Priceline customers, right? They come back and repeat and stay many times at the same hotel. And I think that's just, you know, when you've had a poor travel experience, it just reminds you how much you love the good ones. And so I think people are just a little bit of a creature of habit there. You're going to return to where you feel most comfortable, you know, the area, et cetera. But there's always a mix of people who want to try something new every time they head out. And with the world now really opening up, I think it's much more possible to do that now. You know, the UN World Tourism Organization came out with a stat that said over 900 million tourists traveled in 2022. That's still only 63% of where we were in 2019. But this year, that number could get as high as 95%. So almost back to a full right. worldwide travel recovery.
I got to tell you, I'm one of those people. There's a few places I know I'm going to love it. And I go back. Hey, listen, Brett, just got about 25 seconds here. Lots of geopolitical concerns. Doctors remind us we're still not over COVID completely. What is it that you worry about most when you look at the outlook?
You know, I think our primary concern obviously is the longstanding impact of inflation on consumers' wallet. I think that really is the primary concern now. I think consumers are largely over concerns about health as they travel, and it's now really more about the pocketbook. And, you know, that's what we do here at Priceline. We try to help you get a great deal and get you where you want to go.
That was Priceline CEO Brett Keller, along with Bloomberg's Jess Metten. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, we speak with someone who's always on the move. We're talking about Bloomberg Pursuit's auto columnist Hannah Elliott. She's back from the snowy mountains of Italy to share her drive with a Ferrari first, an SUV.
It really did drive like a Ferrari. It has the signature V12 engine. It sounds like a Ferrari. And they were very proud to have me drive it across snow and ice and off-road terrain. So it is an SUV, even if we don't use that word for it. It certainly remains true to the brand.
This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
In the Pursuit section of the magazine this week, our globe-trotting auto columnist Hannah Elliott explains that Ferrari has pretty much everything. Sold out order books and record sales last year. Margins that key rivals such as Porsche and Mercedes-Benz can't touch. And even a line of what she calls, quote, riotous hybrid supercars. The one thing the Italian automaker never had, an SUV, that is, until now. Ferrari is preparing to release a $400,000 model that it previously swore it would never, never make. Let's bring in Hannah and Bloomberg Pursuit's editor Chris Rouser to tell us about it. Chris, Ferrari and an SUV, they said it would never happen, never, 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 and yet we have it.
Yes. I mean, Hannah and I have been doing this a long time, and they have told Bloomberg that they're not going to make an SUV. And then, you know, Aston Martin made one, Lamborghini, most importantly, made one, Rolls Royce, Bentley, and the pressure was just on, and the margins were just, the profits were just possibly too high, so that they finally caved. And of course, when it came time to test drive it, we wanted to send Hannah.
All right, so Hannah, tell us about it. Were you crazy about it?
I really liked it. I have to say, I didn't really know what to expect. This is the first, not only is this the first SUV Ferrari's ever made, it's the first four-door vehicle, period, it's ever made. So I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I have to say I was pleasantly surprised. Ferrari has done a couple other four-seat vehicles before, the GTC 4 Lusso and the FF. And this kind of looks like those, maybe blown up a bit. I think I was happy with the looks. And, of course, it really did drive like a Ferrari. It has the signature V12 engine. It sounds like a Ferrari. It certainly remains true to the brand. We should note, Ferrari does not like to use the word SUV to describe this vehicle. They want to say it's like a sporty, agile car with larger volumes.
Sounds like an SUV to me.
Yeah, and let's not forget, it does have multiple driving modes. It's got all-wheel drive. It's got a clearance that can lift to allow for uneven terrain. And they were very proud to have me drive it across snow and ice and off-road terrain. So it is an SUV, even if we don't use that word for it. And I have to say, you're right. It's smaller than like some of the SUVs you might see moms driving to the soccer game, it does have a lower roof line, certainly, but yeah, it's an SUV.
So, okay, take us through some of the dynamics of it and the different modes of driving. You got wet mode, slip control, ice mode, you've got comfort mode. Mm-hmm. I'm all in.
We love comfort mode.
Yeah. Who doesn't? So tell us about this trip you took.
Exactly. So one surprise of the trip that we didn't actually anticipate because of weather conditions, we weren't sure if we'd be able to do it, but we did take this. We rode a ski lift to this high alpine snow track that Ferrari had cut into the mountains in the Italian Alps, and we drove it on snow, and it was fantastic. I started out in what's called wet mode, which is sort of a softer mode that makes the suspension softer and the steering softer to try to smooth out everything when you're driving, which was great. That's something that you might use, like, if you're driving to your ski chalet, for instance, or the hotel where you're going to stay where you're skiing.
Oh, yeah, Chris and I were doing that last week. Yeah,
we
totally
just,
on that.
We need wet mode for this.
Exactly. This is what we all really need. And then you can switch. For instance, I switched into ice mode, which sort of tightens everything up. It's a lot stiffer. You're going to feel the bumps and the jolts in the road more, but it's also quicker. It can be potentially quicker if you're really on it. And Ferrari was great. They had actually a professional rally driver with me in the passenger seat who was really coaching me through the drive modes and how to get the most out of the car. And it's pretty incredible. It was really surreal to hear this roaring Ferrari engine that you're used to hearing, you know, on a track or on the freeway in California, to hear that in these Alps. It was very cool.
I mean, this was one of the ones where I was very jealous of you, Hannah, I got to say.
Well, can I ask you, Hannah, yeah. Can I just ask you, though? It sounds like it was incredible. But tell us about the door handle.
So, yeah, you know, there are a few things that we should say about the Purosangue that are
different. I'm being a little picky.
Yeah, the rear doors open in reverse. It's considered a carriage style, so they open in reverse. And to open them, you pull a little lever thing. It's a little smaller than a credit card, and it's positioned on the pillar of the door, on the door, but it's sort of hidden with the door pillar. It's really hard to explain. You don't even really see it. The intent is that when you look at the car, the size, you can't see any door handles. They're totally hidden. When you get close to the door, then you see this little handle that you pull, and it opens and closes the door. Now, the thing about those is they are sort of partially automated, which is meant to be more convenient because then it makes the door lighter to open and it'll slowly close itself. But the thing is, we're so used to just opening and closing and slamming doors really quickly. It takes a little bit of time to get used to this sort of partially automated door. And you can, of course, override it and just push the door closed. But it does,
which is what you did, right? You got
yes, because I'm so impatient. You know, you just get out and you just want to slam the door closed. And once you're sitting inside, there's a button inside that you can push that will automatically close the door. But again, you know, it takes a lot longer to sort of slowly close the door by button rather than just yanking it shut.
In comparison to the other high-end supercar SUVs that are out there, this one holds its own?
This one certainly holds its own. I would say that really the key that everyone's asking about and wondering about is, does it beat the Lamborghini Urus? That was such a fantastic vehicle when it first debuted, and I have to say it doesn't. It's very, very good, but it's also $100,000 more than the Lamborghini SUV, and it's really not any better. It's very good. But the Urus, it just is so striking. It's really, really true to Lamborghini design heritage. It drives possibly even better than the Lamborghini. Some people might hate me for saying that. It's just a better value proposition. The Lamborghini is great too, but I don't think it beats. Or sorry, the Ferrari's great too, but I don't think it beats the Lamborghini.
All right. Well, there's no chance I'm buying either of those SUVs. Just FYI. We just have about a minute left. Chris, I just want to get to one other thing that's in Pursuits. It's a fun section because I'm more likely to go to Sweden's Arctic Retreat than buy one of these high-end SUVs. Just quickly, just tell us about this.
I mean, you may remember recently that a pilot made headlines for doing a 360-degree turn on his flight so that his passengers could see the Northern Lights. And suddenly everybody was like, oh my God, I got to go see the Northern Lights. And you kind of think of the Northern Lights as like standing in a field, which I have seen, like standing in a field, having your toes freeze. Like, then you're like, okay, I saw the Northern Lights. And then you're like, all right, now I'm in Swedish Lapland. What else do I do? And we wanted to do a story about how much other stuff there is to do, what other things to see in nature, what other zany activities to do. You can go mushing, you can go ice fishing, you can do lots of different things. And the Arctic Retreat is this really great, really small place in Swedish Lapland where you can go and just see amazing things and do amazing things.
I have to say, it just looks like so much fun. It looks like you were so out in nature. And I feel like I said, I can't afford the Ferrari SUV, but I think I can afford this. Read more, folks. It's in the Pursuit section, along with a really fun story about a reality show when it comes to artists. There is actually an art reality show. Who knew, right?
Yes, there's a reality show, competition show for artists. And as you'll be shocked to know that our famous arts writer, James Tarmey, was not a fan.
No, he didn't like it. He was not shy about that. Chris, thank you as always. And our thanks to Hannah Elliott. Always so much fun when we get to check in with you guys. The editor of Pursuits, of course, Chris Rauser, and our unrivaled auto columnist, Hannah Elliott. Thank you again both for joining us. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, from elite driving to elite dwellings, we look at the market for 7, 8, and even 9-figure homes. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Underway a broader shift among America's ultra-rich and powerful in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their moves away from places such as New York's Upper East Side and San Francisco's Nob Hill to warmer, less dense regions of Florida and Texas have lifted real estate prices in some locales while leaving other neighborhoods behind. Now, among the Bloomberg analysis findings, New York City falls as Florida gains in a shift of the most expensive areas to live in the United States. Our next guest is seeing this trend as well. Bonnie Stone Sellers is co-founder and chair of Forbes Global Properties. It's a consortium of global firms and brokers that deal in luxury properties around the world. Bonnie stopped by to explain what's hot, what's not, and why.
Prices have remained high. Despite the fact that there's a slowdown in the volume of sales, we're seeing a shortage of supply, and that's bolstering the prices. And it's true that there are new places where the top sales are arising. In fact, Palm Beach had the highest price sale in 2022 at $173 million.
So the price is still high, slowdown in sales. It makes sense, right? If there are not enough properties coming out of the market, basic supply and demand, you're going to see those prices stay high, but it's also ultimately, because the supply isn't there, it's going to bring down the volume. Do you see any of that changing anytime soon?
Well, I mean, if you just kind of look at the trophy sales in 2022, I think you would say that we wouldn't see that changing soon. The top 25 sales in 2022 ranged from $73 million to $173 million. These were higher prices in many locations than we've ever seen before. And many of these are purchased by people where a softer economy, a higher interest rate will have no effect. The billionaires around the world buy all of the homes. This year, more than 50% were in the United States. I think partially that's because the international buyers weren't as fluid during COVID as we hope they will be in 2023. And just to put a fine point on it, kind of interesting, but South Florida had the most top trophy sales in the United States. And that was followed by Los Angeles. And then it didn't happen until we got to Hong Kong that we had an international city in the top three of the top sales, trophy sales.
What is it that's going on in Florida? Is it like, what are you seeing in the time that you've done this? How many years? Is there something really distinct going on in Florida right now?
Well, I wouldn't think there's anything in particular about Florida, other than the fact that there were no taxes here.
Yeah.
But
that's not new, right?
Right. That's not new. But I would suggest that a lot of the amenities that the top buyers are looking for happen to be found in homes here. And those amenities, number one, for 2022, based on our research, are outdoor space. It turns out that people are now investing in entertaining again and being with other people. And they want that outdoor space and a lot of it with which to interact. The second item is being close to amenities that they like to spend time with. Vacation where you live and the beach in Florida is a strong factor as well.
That was Bonnie Stone Sellers, co-founder and chair of Forbes Global Properties. Check out that full interview. You can find it on our podcast feed. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. And a big thank you to Bloomberg colleagues Jess Metten and Mike Regan for sharing some co-hosting duties while Tim is on leave. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday, starting at 3 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal. And you can also see us on Bloomberg Originals, available on Bloomberg.com/originals and streaming platforms including Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Samsung TV Plus, and more. Have a good and safe weekend, everybody. I'm Carol Masser. Stay with us. Today's top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.